The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. Today we're going to deal with a topic that is somewhat off-kilter for us. It is the third installment of the agrarian question that we're going to deal with here tonight. But we're going to deal with agrarianism as specifically a political and constitutional phenomena. And what I'm going to do is going to be very controversial, and that is we're going to deal with the agrarian faction of American political life and the history of American political thought, and that is the movement of the anti-federalists. I've written on the anti-federalists substantially in the past, but no one has quite got the purpose of the anti-federalist way of thinking, because the anti-federalists were vehemently opposed to the American Constitution as it was adopted at the end of the 18th century, shows the mockery of the principles of Republican government that the American Constitution came to represent. Most people who scream and yell about the Constitution as this sort of a sacred document usually have no clue as to how it was created, as to what it represents, and most importantly, who it excluded as part and parcel of the American political regime. And I want to make a general thesis here that I'm going to prove over the next hour, and that is that the American Constitution is a Masonic oligarchic doctrine having nothing to do with Christianity, having nothing to do with anything other than the rule of money and the rule of power. And that ultimately the long-standing thesis that Alexander Hamilton was Rothschild's man in America is absolutely true in one way or another, either directly or indirectly, and that the Federalists were in fact oligarchs and aristocrats who wanted to create and then manipulate a constitution that could be used to maintain aristocratic and oligarchic power. In other words, that the constitution that was adopted, the late 18th century in America, was in fact a highly oligarchic institution that is perfectly consistent with the reign of money and power and media control that exists here at the very end of the year 2010. It is urban, it is materialistic, it is oligarchic, but it was done and it was passed over the heads of those known as the anti-federalists, who in fact were agrarian, who were Christian, who were rural, and who were dispossessed by this Constitution. So I want to throw down the gauntlet to those constitutionalists who believe somehow that the Constitution represented the people and that the Founding Fathers were in fact a unified group. There were two groups of Founding Fathers, one the Federalists, who were very urban and mercantile, and the others, led by Melanchthon Smith and Patrick Henry and others, who were rural and extremely decentralist and anti-banking, anti-financial, in their basic approach. And even that is a very elementary distinction amongst these people called the Founding Fathers. Founding Fathers, as if they're some sort of a unified group, is really more a product of the imagination of patriots, more than it is any real historical set of ideas. And so the result ultimately here is that the Constitution is a death sentence upon American farmers, having nothing to do with any real Republican or agrarian principles, and in fact set the stage for the domination of American money and American capital, having nothing to do really with freedom whatsoever. And the whole semi-literate constitutionalist and patriot movement has to be really historically and philosophically semi-literate in order to function. The fact is that the American Constitution is as much a fraud as the oligarchy who in the year 2010 continues to control and dominate America. So the basic thesis I want to defend here is that the Federalist movement that eventually forced the Constitution, largely through secret debates, to American life, were highly oligarchic and urban. And those who opposed the Constitution, the Anti-Federalists, were agrarian and quite vehemently opposed to the urban oligarchy who imposed the Constitution ultimately on the country. And in fact, ultimately, that the American Constitution was a class phenomenon. The American Constitution was imposed on the United States through an oligarchy of financial power in the major American cities of the time. So I want to talk about three major academic articles that have been published on this question. The first of which is by Saul Cornell, published in 1990, called Aristocracy Assailed, the Ideology of Backcountry Anti-Federalism. And whether Cornell wants to admit it or not, the fact is that the Constitution is a class document imposed on the 13 colonies as an oligarchic form of rule, based on the behavior of the farmers and small landholders in my part of the world, central and south central Pennsylvania. And that the farmers of central and south central Pennsylvania were concerned, well, were largely labeled as the rabble and the mob by the aristocratic framers of the Constitution in New York and Philadelphia. And that when the Federalists refer to the mob, they were referring to farmers in the western part of America who were libertarian anarchists in their general point of view. But the main incident was the so-called Carlisle Riot in 1787, where a group of farmers and anti-federalists rose against the proposed Constitution and ultimately were defeated and destroyed. And it was the Federalists at Dickinson College and in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, on the Susquehanna River, that decreed that the small farmer in Pennsylvania needed to be annihilated. And that as the Constitution was ratified by the states, really the first act in central Pennsylvania was that the Federalists began to round up the Anti-Federalist opponents of the Constitution. And as that was going on, 1787, 1788, the Federalists were seen to be essentially extensions of the Masonic Lodge, the Masonic Lodge being both mercantile and urban against the farming class in this country. And that the Pennsylvania Federalists, especially in Harrisburg and Dickinson College, were promoting the idea not only of a national empire, but of an international empire. And that the Federalist movement, as the Constitution was being debated and then eventually ratified, the Federalists justified themselves and justified their power by describing themselves as the social betters of the Pennsylvania farmer. And that really the Carlisle and Harrisburg Federalists demanded power based on the idea that they were the social superiors and the economic superiors of the small farmers, and the small farmers comprised the anti-federalist movement in this state. And it's around that time where the very first militia against this kind of oligarchic power was formed in Carlisle and in my own town of Chambersburg to create a local militia. The idea is to create a local militia against the oligarchy. The militia movement, as it developed in later decades and centuries, really derives from this same concept, that the Constitution was always meant to be a fraud, and the reality is oligarchic rule using the Constitution for their own purpose. The consistent argument of the Federalist movement is that the rabble, that is the small farmer, can never be trusted, and that the small property owner, the small freeholder, should be removed from public life. This was the mentality of the Federalist movement in Harrisburg and Carlisle. And that in Dickinson College, and this became very important in the academic life of America later on, it is that the Constitution and real Republican government can only be trusted, or entrusted, I should say, to the hands of the oligarchy, to those with money and power. That the Federalists viewed the Constitution as a way to protect the aristocracy, a way to protect the oligarchy, and to keep the small farmer away from power. And the anti-federalists, needless to say, developed a concept of representation that suggested that the representative should reflect the people who elect him. And ultimately, the anti-federalists accused the constitutional movement, or the Federalist movement, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, John Adams to some extent, of using the phrase Republican virtue to in fact refer to the domination of money and the control of money that this Constitution was meant to enshrine. Dickinson College and so many others in the area were of the opinion that only the educated should be ruling America. And even more than that, that the law profession in the urban areas of this country, the law profession was overwhelmingly in support of the Federalist movement of the Constitution. And it didn't hurt their cause that Federalist partisans were in control of the major urban presses in the last two decades of the 18th century. And ultimately, the movement was between the anti-federalist small farmers who were vehemently opposed to the Constitution, who believed in localism and local religion and local religious control, overwhelmingly, against the Federalist movement, which was urban, cosmopolitan, and about creating both a domestic and an international empire. And the Federalist movement in Pennsylvania and New York viewed the aristocracy, the oligarchy, as the only group of people who really fully comprehended the idea of the general welfare. And that the anti-federalists, the small farmers to the west, both of Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, viewed the Constitution that was eventually adopted as a as really a mechanism, as a tool for the oligarchic element. And that ultimately the Constitution was about one thing. The Constitution was about a strong union with a strong executive that existed to destroy all forms of social radicalism, which was defined in the 1780s as the small Christian farmer in the backcountry, with places like Pennsylvania and Virginia and Massachusetts. So what I want to say here is that the agrarian mentality was represented in the 1770s and 1780s in the United States as a backcountry radical militia movement based on the agrarian smallholder. That this was the anti-federalist movement. The federalist movement eventually was to create the Constitution and this conservative constitutionalist mentality that really is little more than a facade of the moneyed classes and the urban moneyed classes to dominate the country and to be able to trade effectively with Great Britain and France and the states of Northern Europe, and that this really was the purpose of the Constitution and the purpose of the American Revolution. So ultimately, that the conservative constitutionalist movement is an entire fraud, and that it existed to destroy the small farmer in 18th century, late 18th century America for the sake of external empire. This is one of the reasons that both Republicans and Democrats claim to support the Constitution, because however you construe it, the Constitution as it was adopted in the 1780s was meant to destroy the Christian farmer, especially the smallholder, freeholder, Christian farmer, that eventually will rise in rebellion against this Constitution, viewing it as a tool of the elite. So really the idea that we're dealing with is that after the Carlisle riots, the first act of the Federalist government that, you know, became the Constitution was the roundup of small farmers of central Pennsylvania and their imprisonment and, for some of them, the execution. The next piece of work, worth talking about is a 1955 article by Cecilia Kenyon called Men of Little Faith. And the little faith actually refers to their complete lack of faith in the Constitution and their lack of faith in representative government as people like James Madison and Hamilton had envisioned. The idea is that the anti-federalist movement, wherever it manifested itself, agreed with the idea that the American Constitution was a class document. It was a way for the urban elite to control the small farmers in the countryside. The anti-federalist point of view was that a real popular government can only really work in small states, or at the very least, in small environments. And even more, that real self-government can only exist in homogeneous populations. That only in areas where the people have you know, major areas in common, race and ethnicity and religion and tradition and these basic, you know, historical experiences, only there can real self-government ever occur. But most of all, the Anti-Federalists throughout America held that the Constitution can never work because the economic interests of all sides were simply too sharp and too great. Because the rich wanted to dominate the poor, the urban wanted to dominate the rural, the Constitution, as it stood, could never work. In fact, the Constitution holds to the view that political society could never really exist except by self-interest. And in fact, the Anti-Federalists hold to the view that political society exists really only for cohesion and defense, not for financial interest. And we'll continue on this topic on agrarianism and American political thought in a few minutes when we come back. So hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are talking about agrarianism again, but agrarianism relative to the particular critique of the Anti-Federalist movement against the Constitution and against the oligarchy in America that was imposing the Constitution on the society. The fact is that the Anti-Federalist movement viewed the Constitution, as it was promoted by Hamilton and Madison, as an oligarchic document designed to protect the wealth and power of that class. And this is something that the Anti-Federalist movement was very closely associated with the agrarian lifestyle, small towns, small communities. That's how they viewed the Constitution. They viewed it as a class document. They held that popular government really is only good for small states and more or less cohesive states. Cohesive especially in terms of ethnicity and religious ideas. And I mentioned that the Federalist Party, that eventually was victorious, viewed political society and thus constitutions as really based on self-interest, and then controlling self-interest. And yet the Anti-Federalists had a tendency to view political society as really based on solidarity for the common good. The Anti-Federalists held that the House of Representatives, which was supposed to be the popular house, was too small. There were so many people that were supposed to be represented by a handful of people, a handful of politicians. And then ultimately, what that would lead to is the rule of money. And of course, they're absolutely correct. Only those who either are wealthy or who can secure the backing of the wealthy are capable of running for the House of Representatives. Even though the fact is that the House was meant to be, at least in theory, the part of the legislature that represented the poorer and middle classes, the small farmer, artisan, etc. And the fact is that really the agrarian criticism is, and it comes up again and again in the anti-federalists, is that under this system, or really under any political system that tries to enshrine popular government over a large area and over a large number of people, will eventually decline into the rule of the cities. Not only in that cities are very powerful and they're very populous and they have a civic life where people are used to working together, but even more, that farmers were always so scattered and often very difficult to mobilize through no fault of their own, that the American Constitution really means the rule of cities and those who rule the economic life of the cities. And so in a very real way, the anti-federalist way of criticism was saying that the bankers are going to end up controlling American political life. Many years ago in the Barnes Review, I wrote an article on the prophecy of the anti-federalists. And it started kind of a cottage industry among anarchists and agrarians and nationalists, in that the anti-federalists had predicted the advent of the income tax. They predicted the advent of the mass, very large bureaucracy, of the standing army, of judicial activism, of the external empire of the United States, of really the police code that exists and dominates in this country. Every syllable of it was predicted in the 1770s and 1780s by the anti-federalist movement. So when someone talks about the founding fathers, the phrase is absolutely nonsensical. You have to be very specific as to who you mean, because the small and middle class farmer, which was, of course, you know, the backbone of the anti-federalist movement, had nothing to do with the so-called founding fathers, people like Jefferson and Adams and Madison, Hamilton, but were vehemently opposed to them on the grounds that they were promoting an oligarchic system of rule enshrined by and protected by the Constitution. Even more than that, the anti-federalist thinking from Pennsylvania and New York held to the view that the national capital will become an arena for power, for paganism, for the worship of matter, for the manipulation of anyone and everyone in this country for the sake of creating empire. And they said this in the 1770s. So if that in and of itself is not sufficient to get you to read the anti-federalists and take them seriously, then nothing will succeed in doing that. The anti-federalists saw political power, concentrated political power, as oligarchy and as ultimately pagan and materialist at its root. Because Washington, D.C. is going to be so distant from the average American, the average American farmer in particular, that it will become an isolated center of crime, death, manipulation, empire, and black magic. Even worse, this black magic was to actually be in the phony coinage or printing of money in the central apparatus in Washington, D.C., which will create value out of nothing, which will create power out of nothing, based entirely on the central and centralized institutionalization of power in the capital, and that the destruction of local currencies is the destruction of state power, and really the enthronement of the worship of money in Washington, D.C., and that this, again, will be protected by the Constitution in one way or another. At the same time, though, I want to make it clear that the Anti-Federalists did not romanticize this concept of the people. I want to say that when someone uses the phrase the people, be very careful. There is no such entity as the people. It is an imaginary entity. There are a lot of these phrases that are in fact imaginary. Things like the international community, global humanity, even humanity as such. These are largely imaginary entities. There is no such thing as a single human interest. But the real central criticism of the agrarian anti-federalist way of thinking is that local institutions, including the extended family, county government, county militias, these are the best ways to control the irrational passions of the average person. And that, in fact, the average person is very fickle. The average person is quite easy to manipulate. And that those that today we might call celebrities, which is just a recreation of the old pagan pantheon, that these people who can be called celebrities, that they are actually, you know, can be used very effectively to control the population. And again, we're talking about this kind of criticism from the agrarian point of view being made in the 1770s and 1780s. George Mason, who was actually one of the upper class anti-federalists in Virginia, held that the Constitution, as it was proposed and eventually passed, was the death sentence for the small farmer. And one of the reasons he said this is that only a bare majority was required for commerce and navigation issues. And of course he had, I think there were a lot of Southerners who had demanded that two-thirds majority should be required for any international trade issues. And that two-thirds majority was rejected by the Federalist Party because they simply wanted, and in George Mason's point of view, they really just wanted a handful of urban areas to be able to dictate the terms of international trade. The Anti-Federalists viewed party politics as really being an adjunct to international trading interests, and they really hated the idea of politics and electioneering. But this was really more about manipulation than truth. So what you have in the 1770s and 1780s is really the urban versus agrarian interest fighting each other under the guise of Federalist and Anti-Federalist. The Anti-Federalists were agrarian. They were based on the small farmer, the worker, the artisan, the middle class and the lower middle class. They were very Christian, they were very localist in their point of view, and based really on the day-to-day function, the identity of the local community. And the Federalists, Madison and Hamilton specifically, were very urban, they were very mercantile, they were based on the idea of capitalist enterprise and the ultimate creation of a global capitalist empire under Rothschild control, and that this really was and that really is the criticism of the Federalist movement from the Anti-Federalist, from the anti-constitutional movement of the agrarians in Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York in the 1770s and 1780s. There's actually a bunch of interesting academic publications on this question. Cecilia Kenyon's 1955 article, Men of Little Faith, Saul Cornell's article, Aristocracy Assailed, published in 1990. And Emery G. Lee III, his Representation, Virtue, and Political Jealousy, published in 1997. All of these are making similar points. They're using a lot of academic jargon, and of course they really won't. Of course, they won't talk about the Rothschilds, although that's come up quite a bit in the career of Alexander Hamilton. Yet there is quite a bit of interesting and usable material here in the founding of the American Republic relative to the agrarian interest and the communitarian interest in the rural areas, and especially the western areas, of the original 13 colonies. I want to make it clear with all of this that the anti-federalist and agrarian way of thinking was anarchist in the best sense of the word. And what I mean by that, to put it in an abbreviated way, is that the anti-federalists made a huge distinction. And this is common in agrarian political thinking, between power and authority. Power is a coercive force. Power can exist under any regime, for any purpose, for good or for ill. Authority is that which naturally adheres to the truth. Authority exists because an institution or a way of thinking or a way of life is true. It is not necessarily coercive, although it could be. But the central distinction between power and authority is that authority can rule legitimately and without coercion, whereas power always requires coercion, because power, if divorced from truth, simply exists through manipulation. But that distinction is huge in the agrarian debates of the 1770s and 1780s in America, because a distant capital, Washington, D.C., or even a state capital, usually has to control the outlying hinterlands and farms through power. And yet the farming life and the family life that it's based on and the Christian life that it's based on exists through its own authority, through its own truth. And that's a big difference, and that's a big distinction. And when Shays Rebellion or the Whiskey Rebellion or Freeze Rebellion or any of these major confrontations between agrarianism and urbanism exploded in the 18th century, it usually was at least at root between the idea of local and familial agrarian authority versus a distant mercantile urban power. And that, quite possibly, is really the foundation of the confrontation between Federalist and Anti-Federalist at this period of time. And why I want to make it clear that the Constitution that was eventually passed over the heads and over a lot of blood, the bodies of the Anti-Federalist and agrarian revolutionaries, in fact, enshrined oligarchy and enshrined corruption in American society. The Constitution is not a sacred document. It, in fact, is a contract, and was even viewed by the Anti-Federalists as a contract on localism and local agrarian interests in the name of a domineering and arrogant oligarchy and aristocracy. And Patrick Henry, remember, made it very clear that the Constitution was written in secret. I mean, that the propaganda was this is going to be an improvement in the Articles of Confederation. And of course, the reality is that they completely threw it out and rewrote a brand new document in secret and then imposed that on the country. And as it was imposed on the country, the radicals and agrarians were rounded up, especially in places like Pennsylvania and, western New York, to silence their opposition to what was developing in American life. So I want to make it clear that the veneration of the Constitution as it was passed back then is a mistake. Referring to the Founding Fathers as some kind of a unified group is just, you know, classic American political amateurism. And the fact is that there was a huge anti-federalist and agrarian movement that was eliminated in one way or another as the Federalist Constitution was imposed on the country. I want to draw on the 1997 article by Emory G. Lee III, Representation, Virtue, and Political Jealousy, as a way to understand and explain agrarian political thinking relative to and opposed to the Federalist Constitution imposed on America. And I want to start that, and I want to conclude, you know, this talk by dealing with this article with the concept that a democratic election, however you want to envision it, is really just a means for the elite that already rules to justify their power. It's a mechanism, and it has no other moral force than as a mechanism. Again, we're not talking about authority. A democratic election does not provide, contribute any kind of authority upon people. It merely justifies their already existing power. And I think that this is how the agrarians and the anti-federalists at the time viewed the Madison-Hamilton Constitution. James Madison made it clear in the Federalist Papers that the representation in America or any other representative government, so-called, is justified not by the election per se. It's justified by the elite status of the person who is elected. The voice of the people, as imaginary and really as ridiculous a construct, especially as a moral or political construct, has nothing to do with the justification of an election or of representation. It's the status of that person who gets elected. The anti-federalists viewed elections as a problem because it justified the existence of radically oligarchic and unequal power relations between city and country, but even more because of the extreme distance between the capital and the countryside, especially back then where you had a great difficulty politically, was communication, especially between the hinterlands, say, of what we would call central Pennsylvania today, or the West back then, and a place like Washington, D.C., or even the state capital. For the anti-federalists, distance was a huge problem, because distance implied a complete lack of responsibility. For James Madison, distance was a benefit. The fact that the capital of America, say, whether it be in New York City or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C., was very far from the hinterlands of this country, which meant, in his mind, that the real aristocracy can do its work unhindered. Now, there's a perfectly justifiable philosophical position for aristocracy. And there's nothing wrong with it as such. The problem is that no anti-federalist at the time viewed Madison's justification of power as having to do with aristocracy. It had to do with oligarchy. It had to do with shipping interests. It had to do with banking interests and even the very, very large farmer against the middling to small farmer that made up the majority of political and social life in the hinterlands of this country. So, in fact, Madison was justifying the Constitution partially on the grounds that the lack of representation of the farming class was a positive thing because it meant that the real aristocrats can do their thing without being interfered with. I think that fundamentally the way that the anti-federalist and agrarian viewed or defined the word democracy or democratic election really was a means whereby political power can be tightly controlled and circumscribed. It was a way of limiting political power for the sake of permitting local nuclei of authority to continue to work and function, and in fact, grow in their authority. The point of democracy, in other words, was to permit the state to exist as only a very small, highly limited, and circumscribed entity, which then, in turn, would empower traditional, local, agrarian, religious, and familial centers of authority to continue to develop in peace, in as much peace as possible. James Madison talked about political wisdom. And nobody is going to deny that political wisdom is, in fact, important to any political system. That everybody, every power structure or power center is capable of being manipulated by passion, but with the anger or jealousy or revenge, and that these things can harm, that these things can distort what would otherwise be an intelligent line of debate or discussion or policy. The problem is that the anti-federalists said that given our circumstances, given America as an increasingly powerful urban shipping and banking community, that there really is no final intelligent way, especially for the Federalist movement, to separate somebody's ability in banking or mercantile life in one way or another with the exercise of political wisdom. That the way Madison is arguing, it doesn't take a genius to figure that the average person, even the average educated person, may begin to equate somebody who was successful in banking or shipping or manufacturers with somebody who is wise in areas of religion or morality or politics. And this was a constant concern of the agrarian movement in the 1770s. Let's put it this way. Madison is famous for saying that if men were angels, no government would be necessary. The agrarian mind would say that if men were angels, government would still exist. It would just be perfect. It would be a perfect community where authority and power were purely and exactly united. They would be totally proportional one to another. The agrarian mind, finally, held that there was no real distinction between power as exercised by a class versus that power's connection to sources of money and other forms of material control. The agrarians, the anti-federalists, confronted Madison and Hamilton by saying that financial power and authority ultimately is all that matters in the Constitution. The state will become merely an instrument, the externalization of that class authority. So to conclude, I want to hold yet again that the agrarian anti-federalist movement was the most powerful movement of prophecy in the early republic, that the Constitution was a contract on the small farmers of this country, and that ultimately the urban mercantile trading influence ended up controlling America in the 1780s and continued to manifest its power throughout American history. Things like NAFTA and the so-called free trade and the rule of money and the Federal Reserve and their domination over the economy, that these things, quite frankly, should be held by true patriots as, in fact, no surprise whatsoever. This was the plan from the beginning. This is something that was built into the Constitution. And I think it should strike you, as I've said before, that when the Constitution was passed in places like South Central Pennsylvania, it was met by the rounding up of the agrarian revolutionaries. And in fact, that the passing of the Constitution was justified because it meant the increasing pacification, violent pacification, of the agrarian agitators of the time. So, needless to say, I am not somebody who venerates the Constitution like so many Protestants do as another book of Scripture. It's nothing of the kind. And that legitimacy, that is to say authority, in American life back then was held by the small farmer and the community that the small farmer has created, and that everything that the anti-federalists and agrarians had predicted would happen in America in the 1770s, in fact, by the turn of the 20th century, had already occurred. So I want to thank everyone for listening. Good night, and God bless.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned into Radio Aryan.